Welcome everyone. I'm Barry and I'm here to chair this session. The optimal solution to the retirement riddle. It seems to me with the FSI, we've had a lot of discussion in the past about retirement and but now it seems like there's a whole level of legitimacy about it, because the FSI is now talking about group pooling, it's about, you know, other issues around protecting against longevity. And so we've had some really good debates, I think, at these sessions. And we've got another one now. So we've got Nicolette Rubenstein, who's the GM of retirement at Colonial First State, and Steve Nagel, who's a partner at Ernst & Young. And they'll be talking for about 30 minutes, taking us through some slides, and then we'll have a discussion for about 15, 20 minutes or so. So would you please welcome Nicolette Rubenstein, who's kicking it off. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Now, Barry and I were actually talking yesterday about how nerve-wracking presenting at one of these actuaries conferences is. There's something about getting up in front of the most intelligent people you know and letting them interrogate you about your work that is quite disconcerting. Now, the funny thing is, this is about the third time that I've presented a paper, and I'm actually feeling a lot more relaxed this time. And you might ask why I would be more relaxed. The first reason is the subject matter. So the last couple that I've done, I've been roped in against my better judgment to doing industry fund versus retail fund comparisons, and I've been paranoid about what the media are going to say and what the industry fund guys are going to think of me and da-da-da-da-da. So I'm on much safer ground on retirement. And the second reason is that I've got Steve up here with me. So any hard questions, I'm just going to direct to Steve. Anyway, on to our subject matter, the optimal solution to the retirement riddle. So it is a bit flavour of the month. We've had about three papers at this conference on similar subject matter. We asked Ernst & Young, we engaged them to do this piece of work for us, mainly to inform both our advice strategy, so what should our advisors be recommending, and our product strategy, what should we be building. And we very much took a customer-centric approach to this piece of work. So put everything else aside and just said what will give the best outcome for the customer in retirement. Now, in terms of our starting position as an institution then, Colonial First State is the biggest provider of account-based pensions. We also have CommInsure, who's the third biggest provider of annuities. And I have to say, my own personal starting position was I was actually quite negative towards annuities myself. So you'll see this piece of work has really said that, the other thing I should point out is it would have been a very neat solution if this piece of work suggested that investing 100% into account-based pensions was actually the way to go. In the end, it hasn't suggested that. And also, I have to say that I've changed my views on the role of annuities in portfolios as well. Anyway, we'll take you through it. So in terms of today's agenda, I'm going to really provide a bit of context for our thinking around this, and then Steve's going to take you through the results of the modelling. Now, as Barry mentioned, really the Financial Services Inquiry has been framing our thinking. And a good place to start is, what is the objective of superannuation? And the FSI suggested that it should be about providing income in retirement. And I think there's sort of broad support at a high level for that. When we look at then what people are getting as income streams in retirement, we see that a lot of people will fall short of the ASVA comfortable level of retirement. An estimate that only around 53% will actually realise that comfortable level of retirement, and that's probably even worse with the latest asset test proposals. The pie chart on the bottom right, though, despite that sort of fairly negative financial outlook, a lot of people, 60% of retirees, are actually feeling positive about retirement. So that is good. Now, going back to our objective, which is to provide income streams in retirement, the question is, well, how many people are taking up income streams in retirement? And this work was done by Rice Warner, and we actually commissioned this piece of work, and we've actually created an index whereby we want to track this over time. But it presents a much rosier picture than people previously thought. So more than 80% of money is actually being invested in income streams. When you look at it by accounts, it is a lot lower, and you can see the right-hand pie chart, about 34% accounts still take a full lump sum. But when you look and you drill down into that, on average, those lump sums are actually quite low, so 45% of them are less than $50,000. So it's a very, very rational outcome. And when you look at what people are doing with those lump sums, they're for the most part very sensible. They're paying off debt, they are investing outside superannuation, they're paying off the mortgage. So this myth about people blowing their superannuation and to live on the age pension is very much a myth. It's very much a tiny minority. When we look at where the post-retirement money is, surprisingly about half of it is in SMSFs, about a third in retail and about 17% in not-for-profit. And a lot of that not-for-profit money is actually public sector defined benefit type schemes. And then drilling into the products that are on offer, particularly in the retail segment, and I sort of adapted this from a ASFA chart, we see that funnily enough, the Financial System Inquiry was quite critical about the range of products on offer that protect against longevity risk. But we have actually got a reasonable array of products on offer in Australia. You know, we've had the lifetime annuities, account-based pensions. We've also had a fair spread of variable annuities. Now, the words variable annuity, when you talk to financial advisors, it's not a very well understood word. It obviously is in the US, but not so much in Australia. In some ways, they were seen as the sort of silver bullet of post-retirement solutions. And, you know, from our product strategy point of view, it was definitely something that we wanted to look at. Fixed-term annuities, hybrid products, so the new Mercer's product would probably fall into that category. And then we've shaded it slightly differently, the deferred lifetime annuities. I think a lot of us think that that is a key part of the puzzle going forward, but obviously they're not yet available. So even though we've got a fairly broad range of products on offer, the reality is the vast weight of money goes into account-based pensions. You can see the left bar. The middle bars is the term annuities, lifetime annuities, and then the right-hand side is the variable annuity, so estimated at about $2.6 billion in Australia. So fairly limited success compared to the very large market in the US of about $2 trillion. And as part of this development of our retirement strategy, I actually went to the US and the UK to have a look at particularly the variable annuity market and what had made it successful there and whether that would translate to the Australian market. And there was a few things that are quite apparent. The first is actually the very high level of commissions that are paid on the variable annuities in the US. So they're actually often in the range of about 7% per annum. So that could have fueled some of that growth. The second thing is particular tax advantages that make them more attractive in the US. And the third interesting thing was actually the acknowledgement of the provider risk associated with variable annuities. So in the GFC, a lot of providers had big problems with the hedging strategies backing on the assets backing those products. And, you know, effectively three or four of them completely exited the market as a result. There's a sort of growing appreciation for the provider risk. So why are account-based pensions so popular in Australia? I don't have to tell anybody here why. They're flexible and offer access to Australian equity returns, or equity returns broadly, I should say. So up until now, everything is actually very rational. Our system's working quite well and quite sensible outcomes, good take-up of income streams. The one remaining problem is how we are dealing with longevity risk. And this is some Mercer's data looking at 65-year-old white-collar people and what their life expectancy is. And really what it demonstrates is there's a very substantial possibility, 35%, that a man will live till 91 and a woman till 93. And you know, that's a really interesting challenge from a financial planning point of view, because you know, a lot of planners will often plan or work out their clients' plans assuming that they'll live to life expectancy, which, you know, for the average population is sort of early to mid-80s. So planning for your client to live into their 90s is actually quite a different prospect. The other challenge that we've got is just how risk-averse clients are, and this just comes up time and time again in our research. Now, interestingly, I've just been looking at some asset allocation data for our account-based pension, and there has been a sort of marked drop in cash allocations and a marked increase in international equities over the last 2 years. But for the most part, the client's inherent starting position is that they want want to put everything in a term deposit, effectively. The other thing that we have to be quite aware of is just how low our rate of annuitisation is as a country relative to other countries. And there's a whole lot of good reasons for this, regulatory structures, rates on annuities in various countries. But whichever way you look at it, we're quite an outlier. And I think that's why it's not surprising that the Murray Inquiry came to the conclusions that it did. Even though we've got these strong rates of voluntary take-up of income streams, you know, that bottom quote there, that the lack of significant market for products with longevity risk protection sets Australia apart from most other developed economies. And the Financial Services Inquiry made those five recommendations relating to superannuation, the middle one being for trustees to pre-select an income product for members' retirement. And in my mind, the actual recommendations sort of hide a lot of thought in the underlying narrative in the Financial Services Inquiry, and these are three sort of specific quotes. And these quotes also reflect this change in thinking from, are we taking up income streams, which we're getting a big tick, to are we taking up the right income streams? And here you can see that the Financial Services Inquiry clearly thought we're not. Superannuation assets are not being efficiently converted into retirement incomes due to a lack of risk pooling and over-reliance on individual account-based pensions. And then the SIPA is the recommended pre-selected, the name for the pre-selected portfolio, a product that has minimum features determined by government, and one of those needs to be longevity risk management. And finally, a combination of underlying products would likely be required to provide these features. For an example, an account-based pension paired with a pooled product that provides longevity risk protection. And I think this is really interesting and important thinking, the thinking around combining products in retirement. So that's the Financial Services Inquiry thinking, and it's really mirrored by a lot of what's going on globally. So on the left-hand side, this was the output a couple of years ago from the OECD roadmap on the good design of defined contribution pension plans. So one of the 10 recommendations was to encourage annuitisation as a protection against longevity risk. And again, that this wording around a combination of program withdrawals with a deferred life annuity that offers protection against inflation could be seen as an appropriate default. So again, this word of around combining products. On the right-hand side, there's been changes in the US to allow 401k money to be invested in deferred annuities. And the bottom right is changes in the UK, obviously reversing compulsory annuitisation there. Now, that could be seen to be going in the opposite direction in some ways, but in a lot of ways it's not. It's actually moving away from the two extremes of either 100% account-based pension or 100% annuity towards combining the two. We've also seen changes locally with Treasury looking in detail at deferred annuities and how they can be brought to market. And we're expecting to hear more about that mid-year, about where they get to. And finally, the other reason that we talk about, well, why is there low take-up of annuities in Australia, advisors don't like them. The interesting thing here, this is Investment Trends research, just showing the growing interest that advisors have in annuities. So on the left, actual usage, and on the right, intended usage, and that's covering that full range of what might be classified as an annuity. So just to conclude then, this system largely is working well at a high level. The key concern is how we are managing longevity risk. The debate has definitely shifted from are we taking up income streams to are we taking up the right income streams. And really a lot of discussion, and it's interesting to see even at this conference, this concept around combining products. So we saw the Rice Warner paper yesterday, and also to some extent John Nichols and Anton Keppel's paper as well, both looking at how you combine products in retirement. So it's with that backdrop that we then wanted to actually model the different products in retirement and the different options to, you know, really give us a true reflection on what we thought the best outcome was. So we engaged Ernst & Young, and I have to say, I'm going to do a little plug for you, but they've done a really fantastic job, and I also want to acknowledge Anthony Saliba, who's sort of sitting here, just wave a bit, who's had a substantial amount to do with the work as well. But, you know, I'm actually particularly proud of the work that we've done together. Thank you. I'll hand over to Steve.
Thanks, Nicolette. Thanks for such kind words as well. I'm going to spend the next 15 minutes or so talking through the modelling that we did to examine these the product combinations. And we'll leave some time for questions at the end. So straight into it. We started off saying we want to find an optimum. In order to find an optimum, we looked at what are the desirable features and said, well, we need to find a trade-off between these. And the best trade-off in some respects. And we start off with a big. We started writing down all the things that we might want. And we got 10 here, and I think we can add more. And every time I see a presentation on retirement incomes, a similar list, and occasionally a few more items get added on. We wanted to drill that down a lot more, so we said we're really interested in income, measures of income, so total income or percentage of target that's met. We're interested in how long. The time, how long does your money last? In particular, how long might you spend after your money has run out before you ultimately die? So how much of your expected life is not covered to give the level of income that you're after? Also quality of income, variability, uncertainty or certainty, and liquidity, capital considerations, liquidity and access to capital. So we started off with a big list. To try and trade off between 10 of those to find an optimum is a big challenge. We reduced the challenge slightly by saying, well, we're going to look at these four principally. This is what we want to put the most focus on, probably in that order. How much income do you get? How long does it last? Do you have access to capital for the time you need it? And as a bit of icing on the cake, let's not forget that any money left over for inheritance is important to some retirees. It's important they might have something left over. Then we said in order to explore these, we're going to employ some models and look at a range of scenarios. So, to start to talk through the model, we've used a stochastic model, but let me not make too many assumptions about the depth. You may have read the paper. If you have, thank you very much. If you haven't, let me take you through just broadly to say how we're using a stochastic model. We're using a stochastic model of asset returns, not of expected life, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later. First of all, I'm going to give some simple illustrations. These are single scenarios, so you run your stochastic model 1,000 times, and we picked out a few representatives so we can see what's happening. First of all, we see someone drawing down their assets. They're drawing down $55,000 per annum from their 380 $100,000 balance, and they run out of money at about age 67. This is a male, age 67, that we're modelling here, and his life expectancy is 21 years. So it's not a success in terms of making income last for lifetime. But that'll give you a brief idea. Secondly, we add in the age pension. In this example, this is the pre-2015 deeming rule change, so you hardly get any age pension and right until the very, very end, and we still run out of money too soon. Now we're also showing what happens. We start off with a good, comfortable level, probably more than comfortable, if you like the ASPA figures, level of income for this fellow. Unfortunately, it runs out at 77, and it's a substantial drop in income. So there's a bit of motivation about the things that we wanted to explore. Level of income, but now we're also talking about, well, what happens towards the end of your expected lifespan, or even beyond the end of your expected lifespan, because some people will live longer. In fact, as we're using median expected life, half of the population would live longer than that date. Everything we do takes into account indexation. So we're indexing the target income. So this gentleman has $55,000 and he draws down that and he indexes that with CPI and that continues to go up. We're indexing the age pension at AWE. Conveniently for us, despite the threat of changing the rules to make it CPI, they changed it back so we didn't have to change the modelling. Who knows where that will go in the future. The difference between the two, in our modelling, around 1% per annum, and that adds up to quite a lot over a lifetime. So we have still a shortfall in income. Next we say, well, let's now examine something more realistic. Let's try and draw down $41,000 per annum. Again, single scenario to show what will happen. Now we change the deeming rules as well, so we get a bit more age pension, and it's starting to take shape. We're still not having our assets last until expected life, though. So I think you get the idea with the stochastic model. We're using stochastic asset returns and looking at defined points along the lifetime scale. Right. Now, just to show, we did have a look at variable annuities. We won't explore them in a great deal of detail, but this is a scenario just to show why we're using a stochastic model, because we wanted to get the richness of the interactions between what happens with asset returns and with age pensions, and it's got all of the richness that you would need to explore what might happen with a variable annuity, which gives a ratchet to and an underpin. This scenario is a great one. If you want to see where variable annuities work the best, it's where your assets rise initially, and you get a lock-in of that income. If you're in a situation where you think the market might rise a lot or fall a lot, it can be a nice bet, and we see the income goes up. The other interesting thing you see towards the end there is a ratcheting down as the SIS minima cut in and force you to make withdrawals. Just wanted to throw that one in to reinforce the point that the reason we're modelling all of the complexity of the asset returns is because there are some interactions that we need to understand. So, next one, also a little side study into what about home equity release, and we find that we improve the situation substantially by including our own home, and I think the message there is if you want more income, having more assets is a great place to start. Nothing really more than that to learn, that if you are prepared to throw more assets into the pool, it's great. We didn't explore this option any further for a number of reasons, and some generic reasons why it's touchy is because I spoke a bit about inheritance broadly, a lot of retirees are attached emotionally to their own home, of course, and they see it as security. They also think of it as an inheritance asset and not that willing to throw it in the retirement pot. Now, maybe this fellow, when he gets to age 80 or so and hasn't got much other resources left, he might rethink that. But right now, his financial planner can't persuade him, so we're stuck with the same situation. We've got $380,000 to make it last. We see in this scenario it's not happening. So the benefit of a stochastic model is that we look at lots of percentiles of outcomes. We look at median outcomes, and we've deliberately chosen to do that. Which looking at median outcome, 10 percentile outcome and 90 percentile outcome. So somewhere in the middle and a good and a bad. In choosing to look at to use a stochastic model, we felt we needed one to take those interactions into account, as I mentioned. However, we also believe that they're difficult things to communicate. I think in this audience I'm very happy talking about stochastic models. If I was speaking to a retiree, a typical retiree, I'm not sure that they would really appreciate the level. Well, I'm not sure they enjoy the level of complexity, and I don't think it would be at all helpful. But I think we can talk about median outcomes, the outcome that we think half the time you'll do better, half the time the worse, and also 10 percentile and 90 percentile. So we're contracting the level of information down into three simple summary statistics of those percentiles. And here we find that even in a very good scenario, we are going to struggle to make income last up to expected life. Only really in strong scenarios do we get to within 10 years of expected life for this fellow. So let's move on now and look at a little more information. That was the approach we took. Now we've taken that approach for five products. We've looked at account-based pension, a combination of account-based pension, or sorry, life annuity first, then a combination of account-based pension plus 25% into a lifetime annuity. Then the fourth one is similar, but we're using a deferred lifetime annuity. Despite the fact it doesn't exist and the tax laws haven't changed for us yet, we're pretending that they have and that it does, and we've modelled it nevertheless. So there's a little bit of fiction in that one, but we felt it's important to understand how it works, and also a variable annuity. What we see from that comparison, in the middle, we're calling these the hamburger charts. So the middle hamburgers show us that what happens at life expectancy. And curiously, the median results, the red dots, are not very much different for all of those products. I won't go into it now, but if you've had a chance to look at the paper, we've stuck an appendix in the back, and there's an interesting outcome you're probably aware of for long-tailed distributions like the log-normal distribution that we've used for asset outcomes and the median versus mean. And the median gets dragged down for riskier products. I'll leave that there. If anyone wants to talk about that later, very happy. So the medians are pretty similar at expected life, and you see the different level of variability. No great surprises on this page. If you look to living 10 years longer or 10 years shorter, you find that if you annuitise more, you're relatively better off if you do end up living longer, and if you die sooner, then it was a bad bet for you. Or perhaps I should say a bad hedge for you. And I think that's how most people think of annuities, as hedging rather than betting. Not much surprising there. We have included any inheritance amount on death. Any amounts left over in the account-based pension gets added on there, which is why you don't see an awful degree of variation. The other fact that's in there is the age pensions modelled within that. And that's a big reason why... because these are net present values, why the living 10 years longer, you end up with a lot more money. It's because you end up with a lot more age pension. So I think we get a bit more insight if we look at income. Here we start off, as we did in the previous examples, with a gentleman aged 67 and a target level of income. So now we've got 43,000 target income and 400,000. We've given him a little more money, made it slightly more realistic. And we see that in the median life expectancy, so living to life expectancy, median outcomes are very similar, except for the variable annuity. I'll touch on that in a moment. But you see a greater degree of variability. This is now a lot more interesting, that we see the products are performing differently. Where you live 10 years more than life expectancy, it's a much clearer case that, of course, you'd be better off with more insurance. And the level of mortality insurance is highest if you buy a pure annuity, next best with a deferred annuity, because your 25% capital allocation to it, if you like, goes further because it's a pure deferred annuity. And then the variable annuity performs quite well because that's got a high degree of deferral of income and guarantee of that as well. On the other end of the scale, you can see, unsurprisingly, the more annuitised products give you less income if you do die early. This just looks at income and ignores any inheritance amount. Now, as I said, I come back on the variable annuity. What holds that one back is there's deferral of income, and we're not really... The measures we're using don't show the benefits of the variable annuity. If you want to see its benefits, you have to look at specific scenarios, such as the market rising initially and getting that lock-in. Those don't really play through when you look at 10th, 50th and 90th percentiles. Beyond this point, then, we said we're going to focus specifically on annuity products and account-based pensions, and we're going to look at the optimum balance of those. And again, it's the same four measures that we're focused on. We're now looking at, this is a slightly different measure of how we trade off products. We've moved to this because we want to be able to pack onto one visual the variable outcomes from living to expected life or living longer, and we dropped off the living shorter at this point. We're more focused on expected life and what happens if you live longer. And we're looking again at the 10th, 50th, 90th percentiles of the market performance. And we're looking at different percentages of capital that may be put into annuity. We're looking at no annuity, 25% and 50%. So right in the middle, the three bars in the middle, I'm going to use my laser on this one here. Here we see the fact these yellow bars are very low, they're pretty much in the zero line, means your income lasts to expected life. So this is a direct hit, if you like. We deliberately chose the $1 million assets and the 70,000 here, not because that's necessarily typical of a retiree, but because there's been so much press about is $1 million enough or is it not for retirement, for a comfortable retirement. So can you hit $58,000 with $1 million? Well, we think so. We think you can hit $70,000. This one, though, is before the budget. So this was right a week or two ago. It'll be interesting to see what happens. We've done the modelling. I'd be interested in your views, how low that might go. What does 70,000 reduce to? I should do a little poll, but I won't just now. Also on here, we've shown 90th percentile outcomes, you're a lot better off, and 10th percentile, a lot worse off. Not very much different between products. The reason for that is when we're changing between products, we try and keep the asset mix about the same. So we're using a balanced fund for the account-based pension, but when we start to increase the level of annuity allocation, we're upping the growth proportion of the account-based pension. So our overall asset mix in nature is quite similar between those. The most notable thing, though, is that if you live to 10 years beyond your expected life, the black bars, then you've got a significant gap there. This is with account-based pension only. This is purely a sum of the income gap, if you like, the difference between the amount you want and the amount that you get. So those, the quantum of those would be quite exaggerated. You might argue maybe we should look at real value, maybe we should look at discounted value, but just interpret them as that and see the differential, that if you annuitise some more, obviously it's a lot less. Interestingly, in a very strong market, you can still exceed your $70,000 a year and live 31 years with that income rather than 21 years in the 90th percentile market outcome. So there's quite a lot of variability from the markets. So, interestingly, so 70,000, does that sound right to enough income? Can we live off $1 million and get 70,000? Could we? Well, we think we could. How much do you think it's going to go down with the new asset test? Anyone done the sums? More than 5,000, less than 5,000? Not sure. All right, let me scroll forward. Here's what happens when we first of all bring up the threshold. So the threshold going up is a benefit, and then we increase the taper rate, and it pops down. But not an awful amount there, so we lose some income. Let's have a look. If we try $67,000, pretty much bang on. So we're finding that with $1 million at retirement, the change in the tests knocks $3,000 off your income. I'm sure you'll miss it, but I think some of the press commentary has been rather more dramatic than that to date. So, probably a topical example, but rather more than the typical quantum. So far we've started exploring all the products. We've narrowed it down a little bit to combinations of account-based pension and deferred annuity. Now we said, well, we haven't really got to the optimum yet, so how do we do that? Thanks, Barry. I'll be very, very briefly go through this. We said what's important is the income shortfall. Do you have enough money or not? And we said if you have more annuity, you can change the nature of that to... and this, you don't just need an annuity to do that. You could do that by changing your drawdown. The thing we don't show off the right-hand side is the annuity carries on until you die. We'd said we could use a utility curve, perhaps, because the utility curve should punish a deeper shortfall more than a shallow shortfall. So if the same quantum of money, you should feel more pain for more loss. We did all of that, and we modelled it, and it was very interesting. And we found the result depends an awful lot on the shape of a utility curve, which depends an awful lot on you. And if we're trying to optimise for an individual, all we find is that we need to pick the right utility curve for an individual. We didn't go to the step of asking a sample of retirees what their utility curve looked like. We didn't think that would be terribly fruitful. So we moved in a different direction. The other thing the utility curve didn't do for us was it didn't measure the degree of liquidity in the solution. It did tend to point towards, well, annuities are looking even better, if you like, because they smooth things out as life changes, and they tend to give you a longer, shallower gap in income, but they do have less liquidity. We need then to make another assumption about what that cost, what that's worth. That, again, is individual. So we move to this rather more colourful approach of colouring in what happens with the depth. So if we see a particularly deep shortfall here, we can colour in the outcome to it'd be like a rather more emotive or subjective impact of the shortfall. I won't spend too long on these because they are on the paper if you want to dig into them. But the message on this one, for instance, here we're trying to pack more and more information onto the slide, which is why we're using the colour as well. That if you, for instance, live to expected life plus 10 years, these bars here, then you will have some years of shortfall, some years where you have all the income you want, but a number of years, around 9 years of shortfall, and a deep and unpleasant 50% shortfall for 9 years if you haven't taken any protection. But if you've got an annuity in place of 50% of your portfolio, it's a much less significant shortfall for the same amount of time. So the point of this is to be able to start to put this in front of the end user so they can understand for themselves versus their own utility or preferences what's the optimum mix for them. That's more of the same information, so I'll skip through it. So having got to this point, we said, well, that's all very nice, but I wouldn't fancy putting this in front of anyone or trying to then ask them to pick the level of annuitisation in their product. It's too confusing, it's too much information in one place, and it doesn't really focus in on what they want. So what we did, I should say, what Anthony did over a couple of weekends, thank heavens for some rainy weather, he's produced an app which can go through it for you. So you start off with someone with a $400,000, and we find out that he can't take $70,000 or $65,000 or $60,000 or $55,000 or $50,000, maybe $45,000 if he's lucky. But we got down to around $40,000 of income for this individual. We said, okay, well, that's account-based pension only. That's what you can have. We can play around here with an asset allocation and watch that vary these live. And then we can start to, having picked $40,000, we can start to compare different levels of annuitization here and here. Now, the reason we thought this was the right solution is because we didn't think you could optimize away from an individual's specific preferences, and we thought we needed to be able to narrow things down, not to have 18 bars on the page and ask someone to understand them, but really just filtering through, gathering the information, ruling things out, and moving on to understanding preferences at the individual level. So here we can look at this as an outcome, whether that's okay, and whether this is a problem or not, or whether we're kind of happy, or we don't expect to live that long, or we're not particularly risk averse, or perhaps we worry more about a drop in income after retirement. So that's where we took that. I'll go through this very briefly. The concept that we're following here is to say there's an older world where we used to understand what clients wanted, where we built the products and did all the testing. And this was, if you like, as I started talking today, a little bit of the approach we're taking. Then we take it out to a client and advisor and ask them which one they want, providing lots of information. I think what we're moving towards is something a lot more like this, where we have very simple product combinations. So I think account-based pension annuities play into that very nicely, as will deferred lifetime annuities when they exist. And then we provide those to the clients and give them good tools to enable them to understand, for their needs, what is the true optimum. So that's the conclusions here. Really just those points. We can do quite well here with account-based pensions on their own, but they don't really fill the gap for people who live beyond life expectancy. Life expectancy was a median measure. We've got 21 years for a male there, longer for a female, even longer for a couple, and half the people will live beyond that expected lifetime. So not paying some attention to that is surely a mistake. The financial metrics don't flatter variable annuities, I've said already. Going back to that conclusion again, we think you're better using combinations, but you need to effectively communicate the pros and cons of that to a retiree, and you'll find several retirees who seem to have the same amount of money and the same income needs will have different preferences for how much they'll purchase. And just from my perspective, seeing how little annuity penetration there is in the Australian market, I think if they're well communicated, there's a lot more upside. So that's the final thing for me is, again, to acknowledge Anthony for all his hard work. Anthony's done the real work on the modelling. Now I just stand here and take the glory in producing a wonderful app. If anyone wants to see the app afterwards, we've got it hanging around. I won't do a demo now. And also Matt Gardner, who worked with Nicolette and Anthony and myself in producing all this information. So thank you very much.
There are speakers around. Is there one over there? Yeah, and one here. Just quickly before people have a think about the questions, one of the issues in my mind was because we're mixing products here, therefore we're mixing assumptions. So you're assuming a price you're paying for an annuity, and that's therefore got assumptions embedded into it. And some of these are quite sensitive to that assumption. To what extent, you know, so how have you worked out that price to make it consistent, the assumptions consistent with the variable annuity?
Yeah, thanks, Barry. That's a great question, and it's incredibly sensitive to that. So we picked a few different, what we call market outlooks, and we made sure we're very consistent with the assumptions there. So we built an annuity pricing model, and we calibrated that so that it was consistent with the leading annuity provider at the time. I think you probably know who that was. Then we made sure that we're very consistent with our asset assumptions. So our asset model drove the returns for the account-based pension, and it also drove the pricing for the annuity. So we're very sensitive not to have a distortion because of that.
Yeah, so you use real prices, not?
We started with real prices. We calibrated models based on that. So we had an asset model and a mortality model with various other loadings, which gave us prices at the time consistent with the market, with the market prices for assets and the market prices for annuities, and then we kept that consistency through the model.
Okay. Any questions?
I'll get up at the lectern.
Any other questions? So if you can just mention who you are, because this is being recorded, etc. So.
Yeah, Mark McClanahan. Just got a question for Nicolette. The interesting results coming out of that work that you've done in partnership with EY, are you able to share with us any impacts that might have on how CBA is going to develop new products in the future, and how it might impact how you train your advisors and what they're going to be doing with their customers?
On the advice side, we have looked at how we can provide more guidance to the advisors on how to use annuities. And the stuff that Steve went through, and sorry, this is a bit of an aside, but, at one stage I was looking for what is the optimal allocation to an annuity, so what percentage should be recommended. And, as Steve said, you can't do that because it depends on if the person wants to, they want to leave an inheritance, what their liquidity, what their, risk tolerance is. So in my mind, we ended up with what I would call sort of tram lines of, for most people, anything between 0 and 50% actually being a justifiable allocation to an annuity. And depending on your client, you can go at either end of that. So that's sort of the advice side. On the product side, you could see the attractiveness of the deferred annuity. So we very much, from an advocacy point of view, supported the changes there, and hopefully would want to take to market some sort of deferred annuity in the future. Based on this result and a lot of what we saw overseas, we've decided not to build a variable annuity at this stage, so that was also a decision. And that's not to say that they can't have a role, and I think there's going to be a lot of evolution in that variable annuity space as well, different ways of doing it. And probably the key thing that we are, two things that we're doing right now is, because this is all suggested that combining products is a good thing. We've moved to put annuities onto our platforms, First Choice and First Wrap, so that basically clients can go in and buy an account-based pension and an annuity at the same time, be that annuity a lifetime annuity or ultimately a deferred annuity, or as Rice Warner were talking about yesterday, a deferred purchase annuity where you buy it when you're a bit older. So that's the one sort of area that we've focused on. And the other is CommInsure reviewing their annuity offer, really because we've got a belief that annuities play a much will play a much bigger role going forward.
Any other questions? We've still got 4 or 5 minutes or so. Yeah. Eddie up the back there. Oh, Eddie and then Paul.
Eddie from Resia. One of the questions I always have about trying to think about structuring things is that the whole superannuation thing is such a political ball game, and to buy an annuity now or structure something now is based on the current arrangements, and we can see that the government's always playing around with super. I don't know how you put in a cost in your modelling about what is the cost of being locked into something now that you may not be able to get off in the future, whether it's a deferred annuity or a lifetime annuity versus, not to say an allocated pension you don't get locked into, but obviously that allows a lot more flexibility to use your money in the future. I don't know how you think about what the cost of that option of getting locked in is.
And it's sort of what Steve was talking about earlier about the assumptions, but we ran these different scenarios, so a low interest environment, medium interest rate environment, high interest rate environment, and looked at the current annuity pricing as if you bought annuity now and it remained a low interest environment. Also, if you bought an annuity now on the current rates and it became a medium interest rate environment. And the interesting thing was, you know, a lot of the output didn't actually change that markedly. So that gave us confidence for all those people that think interest rates will ultimately go up, and you know, maybe you don't want to recommend to your client right now that they lock themselves into a low rate annuity, that the output in my mind didn't change that much, so that decision to lock in annuity now didn't look that unfavourable, actually.
Yeah, the other comment, I think you're right, and since we started looking at this and building models around this, we've seen the indexation on the age pension change from AW to CPI, then back to CPI again. We've seen the assets test change last week. So it is rather difficult. We really just modelled based on the situation we've got. And the truth is you don't know whether you're going to miss out by locking in or miss out by not locking in, or whether you're going to be better off, because there's a chance you're better off, that you're better off now by not locking in, or you would have been better off if you had. It could go any which way. So I wouldn't like to say it's lazy, but we've taken the approach of just saying we'll model what we know now and today.
Paul, do you have a...
Paul Francis, thanks for this. I found today and yesterday very useful in terms of helping to deepen an understanding of options and how variable things can be. It seems to me the one gap, and Nicolette, I'd ask you to comment on this if I could. The one gap we have is understanding what actual retirement income needs are over time as people move through active retirement to inactive retirement into a period where they might have some very intensive healthcare costs. And so sort of aiming for a flat level of income over a period of time in retirement just seems to me to be something that's sort of helps us understand but doesn't really get us a lot closer to what individual needs may well be. How can we close the gap in terms of understanding what income needs are over time?
And it is a good question, and our modelling does assume that constant, you can see from the charts, that constant level of income. ASFA actually did some work recently looking at the, you know, so in their ASFA retirement standard, they look at what's needed for a modest and a comfortable level of retirement, and then they've looked at what's needed by older Australians, I think into the 80s and 90s. The interesting thing there was that the overall level of income only dropped, and I can't remember the number, but it was about 10%. So it was actually a lot less than you might think. And the reason for that is that the composition of the income changed, so less leisure, but more spend on medical costs. So, you know, that gave me some comfort that doing a just a straight line approach isn't too bad a proxy. The area that we haven't done a lot of work on, which sort of I'd like to look a bit more on, is that funding aged care and that big lumpy kind of requirement later in life, which, you know, I think really the two solutions that lend itself to that problem are some sort of equity release from your home or reverse mortgage type solution, or some sort of insurance solution as well. Because with aged care, you don't know if you're going to need it, you don't know when you're going to need it, and you don't know for how long you're going to need it. So it really does lend itself more to an insurance solution than it does to any kind of saving solution.
Okay, I'm afraid we've come to the end. Would you like to thank Nicolette and Steve for their presentation? Thank you.